hello there, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at kuci.org. We're on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, February 13th, 2019. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My guests today are Christopher Castellani and Susan Shapiro. First up is Christopher Castellani. Christopher is the son of Italian immigrants and a native of Wilmington, Delaware. He lives in Boston, where he is the artistic director of Grub Street, the country's largest leading independent creative writing center. He is the author of three critically acclaimed novels, A Kiss from Maddalena, The Saint of Lost Things, and All This Talk of Love. He was on last with The Art of Perspective, Who Tells the Story, a collection of essays on the point of view in fiction. I should know this because I talked to him about it, and I have the book, and I just read it again before our talk today. But his new novel is Leading Men, just published by Viking Penguin, and it will be the focus of our talk this morning. Hi, Chris.
Good morning, Barbara. How are you? Nice to talk to you again.
Great. Great to have you. And yesterday was launch?
Yesterday was the launch. It was intense. It was wonderful.
It's like one of the best days, right?
Oh, my gosh. It is just the whole emotional spectrum.
Yeah.
Including fear, looking at the weather forecast in Boston. They were calling it a horrific slop fest. And I thought, I hope they're not referring to my reading tonight. But it was the commute into where I was having my reading was just about as bad as it could be. And yet 130 people showed up. So
excellent.
That was pretty cool.
Well, tell us about Leading Men. How did the book come about?
Book came about, it's really been a book. It's really a book that I've been thinking about and studying and researching and writing for over 20 years. In the late 90s, I came upon a kind of tell-all memoir about Tennessee Williams written by a contemporary of his. And he used bookstores, sort of leafing through it, and I found out about this guy, Frank Merlo, who was Williams' partner of 15 years during the height of Williams' career. And I learned that Merlo was a working-class Italian-American truck driver from Jersey, and I was a working-class Italian-American guy from Delaware, as you've just told your listeners. And I thought, I sort of felt a kinship with him, and I thought, how in the world did a guy like me essentially end up with one of the sort of, you know, the greatest playwright of the 20th century? And so I really just became fascinated with him and what it was like to be, you know, living in the shadow of that genius and the partner of a person of that genius. What was that like? And so I started writing about them, and I wrote a short story, and I wrote a novella. None of it was working, and I just sort of, over the course of the years, as I wrote my other books, I kept revisiting it, rereading Williams' plays, reading letters, reading journals, visiting Italy, where they spent a lot of time, and it just sort of coalesced over 20 years.
Well, it's interesting because I mentioned The Art of Perspective, and I started reading it again. I read it again before, maybe over the weekend.
Wow.
And it was interesting because somewhere in there you mention, I think page 130, you mentioned Tennessee Williams. And so so I was thinking, was he working on the book when he was working on this book? So I guess you were.
I was. And in fact, I wrote The Art of Perspective, Who Tells the Story.
Mm-hmm.
That's the subtitle of the book, because I had all this material about Williams and Merlo and other writers at the time who they were associating with, and I knew I wanted to write about them, but I didn't know who would tell the story, and I didn't know how that person would tell that story. So I really wrote Art of Perspective really for me. I'm glad you liked it, but I really wrote it for me, so I could figure out how to write this novel.
Yeah, interesting. And I also read that you first tried doing a short story with the material, and that didn't work, so you tried a novella, and it still didn't work, so you went for the novel form. Now, is that accurate?
Yep. That is correct, yes. And then, in fact, I then repurposed that original short story and turned it into a one-act play that I worked into the plot of this novel. So I'm a good recycler, you could say.
Well, it's usually the other way around. You know, it's usually, I think, what I hear is, you know, writers starting with the novel, trying that. If that doesn't work, see if it's a novella. If that doesn't work, maybe there's enough for a short story. So that was really interesting.
Yeah, I went the other direction. I just, you know, there was something in that original story. It was the only story, you know, your writers, your listeners out there who are writers in grad programs, things like that. It was the only, every single short story that I wrote in graduate school was slaughtered in workshop. I mean, not even, and that's a kind way of putting it. I just could not write a short story to save my life. And that the story I wrote about Williams and Merlo was the only story that got some love, and I thought, okay, maybe there's something here, you know. And so, you know, take heart, anyone who's in workshops who is struggling.
Well, this would be a great time to hear a little bit from leading men. Let's have you read.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is from chapter one. This is the very beginning, so I hope I won't have to set up that too much up.
Okay.
Truman was throwing a party in Portofino, and Frank wanted to go. The invitation came in mid-July, slipped between parentheses in the long, gossipy paragraphs of his letter to Ten, as if daring him to acknowledge it. Frank read the letter in Ten's absence. He'd been stuck for weeks in their stuffy fourth-floor apartment on Via Firenze, waiting for him to get back from Spain, while on the loud streets below, the real Romans escaped for the mountains. He replied to Truman with a brief telegram, and then he called the finest hotel in town, the Splendido, to book a room. He auditioned various linen jackets and swim trunks and hats in the mirror above the dresser, mended two pairs of Ten socks, and walked their silks down to the cleaners. When Ten returned home to find their bags lined up in the hall, packed for another trip, he didn't protest. He was sweet on Frank again, after 3 weeks apart. A drive in the Jag up the coast of the Guria, far from the melting heart of the Centro, could only make things sweeter. They left Rome, the heat and storms behind them, the top down, for Portofino. Frank slept most of the way, his head on Ten's lap, and then again on the skiff from Rapallo, though Ten kept nudging him awake to point out the houses on the cliffs. "You like the orange?" he asked. "The yellow?" "No, that blue up top. I'm shopping, Frankie. Any of these can be ours." Truman had rented an apartment a few steps from the harbor, above the Delfino restaurant, which Frank and Ten passed on their way up the hill to the Splendido. Ten paid the boat guy to carry their luggage, and when the hill got too steep, Frank grabbed the heavy case with the typewriter. He didn't like it when another guy did work for him that he could do himself, a guy who would have been him if he'd never left Jersey. The Splendido was first a monastero, the boat guy told them, and now look at it, che spettacolo, the place Clark Gable drinks his brandy to a view. Ten went straight to the desk as usual, and Frank arranged their dress shirts on hangers and brought their shoes down for shining and stole another hour for a nap. He'd never felt so tired in the middle of the afternoon, and he chalked it up to being 30, but it's possible no doctor was ever able to tell him for sure, one way or the other, that the trouble had already started in his lungs. When he woke, Ten offered him a pill. Ten had as many pills as Italy had houses on the water. But Frank wasn't taking pills, not then. Instead, he smoked another cigarette and paid the boat guy to drive him over the mountain to Paragi Beach, where he swam to find the strength and clear his head. They didn't like Truman much, but Frank didn't hate him the way Ten did, or maybe Ten didn't hate Truman. It was hard to know for sure with Ten. It was a job in itself, keeping track of who he was angry with and who was jealous of him, whose parties he was looking forward to, and whose they'd have to make up some excuse to get out of. Frank's official job was as Ten's secretary, but even his secretary didn't have a reason for being in Portofino other than to stop by Truman's party, and he didn't know when they'd be leaving. There wasn't much Frank knew in the summer of 1953, least of all, how long he and Ten might last. I'll stop there.
Oh, thank you so much. That was Christopher Castellani reading from Leading Men, just published yesterday.
Hot off the press, as they say.
Very hot off the press. Well, you know, as I was reading this book, I found myself thinking the author, the writer has disappeared. And that is such a wonderful thing, because so often when I'm reading, somehow I'm conscious of the writer writing. And now, I don't know, I mean, that obviously is indication of your strength as a writer, but how do you do that? I mean, is it sinking so far into point of view that you just really have disappeared and the characters are doing what they do and you're following them or what? I mean, can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, first of all, that's an incredible compliment, so thank you. That is what every writer, I think, aims for, is, you know, is to disappear and is to create something that feels organic, you know, that feels like it just kind of grew up out of the ground somewhere, and so that's a huge compliment. And I mean, I don't, other than, you know, studying, I study the tools of craft a lot. I don't believe in rules of craft. I don't believe in, you know, that there's a right way and a wrong way to do things. I believe when it comes to craft that it's learning. It's just learning better what the tools do so that you can make a better decision about how to use them in your particular story, novel, poem, whatever you want to call it, or, you know, whatever you're writing. So I hope that, you know, studying point of view and character and setting and style and reading books in various, you know, various types has taught me to, you know, learn the tools of craft. And then just on a really practical note, when this novel is narrated by two different characters, or they switch off chapter by chapter, you know, one chapter after another, and when I was in the Frank chapters, I was playing music that Frank would have listened to. I had the Pinterest page up with photos of him, and when I was writing the other character, I had Swedish folk songs, and I had photos of Greta Garbo and Liv Ullmann and people like that. And I mean, it sounds silly, but I just needed every possible form of sensory experience as a way of helping me to inhabit them as narrators.
I love that, the music aspect. I mean, I've thought of that in terms of, you know, memoirs writing along to music that, you know, maybe was from that time in their lives or whatever, but it's really interesting to do that with your fictional characters. Yeah, that's great. It's a great little tip.
Plus, it's fun. It's nice to have that in the background.
Well, what about liberties? Like, what kind of liberties can you take when you are basing a work of fiction on actual people?
Sure. Well, really, you can take whatever liberties you want. Different writers make different decisions about what works for, you know, their goals and their, you know, unique projects. I know some writers who part of the goals of their work is to ignore what really happened. I mean, obviously, we have, you know, things like Sense and Sensibility and Sea Monsters, you know, and Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, you know, stuff that really goes, you know, far and takes things that absolutely could never have happened and twist the reality of history or real people. And that's part of that unique goal. For me, I really wanted to write in with this novel. I really wanted to write into the cracks of history. So the thing, like in between the things that we knew about where these people were, where these characters, Frank and Ten and the others in the book, where they were, so that everything in this book, it was very important to me that everything in this book could plausibly have happened. As far as I'm aware, there's no evidence that the plot of this book could not have occurred. There's no evidence that it did occur in some places, but there's also no evidence that it didn't. So it was very important to me to keep those constraints, and in fact, I felt much more able to access imagination within those constraints than I would have if I sort of blew it up completely and just wrote whatever came to mind about what Tennessee Williams and Frank Miller were doing with their lives. And I have, you know, I have a friend, Thomas Mallon, a wonderful novelist, historical fiction novelist, and he always reminds me that when it comes to historical fiction, the noun always trumps the adjective, right? It's fiction, the fictional elements, the storytelling, the narrative thrust is much more important than getting things historically right. We're not writing biography here. You know, we're illuminating a character using the tools of fiction. And that's the first goal is not like your responsibility is not really to Tennessee Williams or to the real Tennessee Williams or the real Frank Merlot, your responsibility is to the reader, to give them a reading experience that is rich.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, I love that. But, you know, in terms of what happened or what didn't happen, so they're mm-hmm. about 100 pages in, there's this horrible attack on Tan mm-hmm. and Frank and their group by a mob of boys. And it's so mm-hmm. brutal. And so, mm-hmm. of course, I'm wondering as I'm reading, was that based on an actual attack?
Mm-hmm. Well, that is based on, that was a very, first of all, a very difficult scene to write and a intense scene to write.
Yeah.
And that and so much of the book in places is really a kind of funhouse mirror version of one of my favorite of Williams's plays, Suddenly Last Summer.
Mm-hmm.
It's not his best play necessarily, but it's his weirdest and it's sort of most perverse, and in that way I find it the most interesting. And he claimed that that play, in which a mob of essentially cannibals attacked a young gay poet, he claimed that that book was the result of nightmares of his own and of psychoanalysis.
Mm-hmm.
And so I made it. So in these 2 weeks, missing from his journals in which I set this book, I put forth the option that, in fact, this actually did happen, and he used this event that occurred in Italy as the material, the raw material to create Suddenly Last Summer. I twisted it around. I changed the genders. I did all sorts of things to twist it around. But that's what he would have done to the story mm-hmm. himself. So, and I just found that the themes that Suddenly Last Summer bring up were particularly resonant for this book. So I really wanted Suddenly Last Summer to be a part of it somehow.
Mm, yeah. And you know, as you were talking about that, I was thinking of your other novels. And is it easier basing a novel on real people, or is it harder? I mean, or how is it different, I suppose? I mean, I suppose if you're totally fictionalizing, you're coming up. I mean, actually, who does totally fictionalize? You take something from life, you know?
Totally fictionalized. I'd love to meet them.
But, you know, it's like working within the constraints, if there are any, of using real people. What do you prefer?
Well, here's the thing. I've really never been able to write a novel, you know, don't tell anyone. I've never really been able to write a novel that wasn't based on people that I knew. So my first three novels were, you know, inspired by my family, and most of the characters in those books, the principal characters, not the minor characters, but the principal characters were started as were based on people in my family. I change things left and right. They don't match up one on one, but I use them as a kind of template, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so in a sense, it's not what I did with my first three novels is not much different from what I did in this novel. I took a real person and I turned them and twisted them around and made them into something else. It just happens that you know Tennessee Williams and Frank Merlot and you mm-hmm. don't know my mother and my father and my cousin and that sort of thing.
Yeah, it is funny when writers say, oh, yeah, this is such total fiction. And it's like, okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Sure. Nope. Yeah, I mean, you know, as I said, not every character, but some of the main characters were certainly started as, you know, not that you have to write what you know, quote unquote, but you always start with something that you're grounded in, you know, an image, a person, an experience you yourself had, and then you allow the magic of imagination to take over.
Hmm. Yeah. I love that. And, you know, I found myself as I was reading as well, looking up people like, was there a mm-hmm. Jack Burns? And, you know, are there memoirs written by Tennessee Williams? There are, and it's in the library today, mm-hmm. so I'm going to pick it up. But you know,
oh, those are fabulous. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's really interesting. I've sort of been on a fiction based on something, you know, someone mm-hmm. that I know of, something that happened, and then I find myself researching. And speaking of mm-hmm. research, how mm-hmm. much? I mean, you said this book took so many years, but Did you really feel like you had to do a ton of research before you really got it right? Or did you, did the research kind of go hand in hand with the writing?
It, the latter, and the, no, in the former, sorry, that's what I meant. even though I had that short story and that novella that I was, you know, working on here and there, I really was mostly just immersing myself in the plays and the letters and journals and things like that and experiential research. So going to Italy and going to parts places that they visited, Provincetown as well, and because I really wanted to kind of almost like just get them in the bloodstream, you know, just really immerse myself in them before I really fully embarked on the novel. And more importantly, to be honest, this is a novel about a long-term relationship between two men. And if I had tried to write this book in 2000 or so when I was in grad school, I'd only been in a relationship with my own partner for a couple years. And there's no way I could have truly understood what goes into a 15-year relationship with, between these two men. There's no way I could have known what I know now, you know, 21 years later after my partner and I have been together. And so I think I brought a lot of that kind of experience to this book, not in any way that this novel is about us, but it, you know, with the experience of being in a relationship, you bring that, to a work like this. So it was really both. It was life that was my research, and it was the actual research of Tennessee, of, you know, his journals and letters and plays.
How does, you know, you do an awful lot of teaching, it sounds like. How does that affect you as a writer, or how does the writing affect the teaching?
Sure. I teach in the wonderful MFA program at Warren Wilson, which is a low residency program every other semester. So every other, and it's a, by low residency, we're together for 10 days in the beginning of the semester, all together in these intense workshops and seminars and lectures and all of that. And then for the rest of the semester, I work one-on-one with two or three students who send me their work. And we, you know, basically they send me a manuscript. I send back some comments and some teachable moments. And then they revise it, send it back. And it's like a more of an edit, it's almost like an editorial relationship. And I learned so much from both of those experiences as a teacher. I learned so much from trying to teach them craft concepts at the residencies and learning from other professors who are teaching craft in their own way. And then I'm learning so much from giving back this advice to these students at these teachable moments. So really, it's a very selfish act that I'm getting paid for. I'm getting my own education from wrestling with all these craft issues with the students every other semester. I couldn't do it every semester. It'd be too much. It's too intense, and it takes too much time away from my own work. But that really does. They feed each other. Obviously, the writing that I'm doing is being fed by the teaching, and vice versa. Because the way I teach, I'm going to say real quick, the way I teach is, we have to give a lecture every year, and I always base the lecture on a question that I can't answer about my own work, you know? So a problem that I've been having, and I bring the problem to the lecture, and I use the lecture to try to work through it. And to me, that's the best way to teach and to learn.
That's fascinating. Now I have to think about that. But I'm not going to think about it too much.
If the teacher is teaching you something that they know, then you're in trouble. They should be giving you a problem that they're trying to solve. Anyway.
We should have taken a whole hour. We're out of the end of our time. I wonder if you have any sort of last words or advice for the writers who are listening, maybe working their way through a book or dealing with historical fiction or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's not going to be groundbreaking advice other than what I've already said about, not throwing away anything and, you know, using things you've already written and transforming them. It's such a cliche, but I feel like the reason for the success of this book is truly because I was completely in love with the two main characters, and I just wanted to be with them. You know, I wanted to spend time with them. And if the thing that you're working on is not something that is on some level a labor of love, if you're feeling like you're working on a book report, an assignment, rather than or something you feel like you should be writing about to appear serious or whatever your goal is, then Writing is hard enough. Like, be with people you want to be with. Choose your friends wisely. You know?
Yeah, if you're sitting there clenching your jaw every time you open the pages, maybe it's something you need to put away for a minute at least, if not if not longer.
Exactly. Figure out how to have fun with it, you know?
Yeah. So. Christopher, thanks so much for being on the show. I really love talking to you, and I wish you the best with Leading Men.
Thank you so much, Barbara. It's always a pleasure. I'll see you next time, I hope.
I hope. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. That was Christopher Castellani. His new book is Leading Men. Oh, yeah. Check it out. You have to check this one out. But I am going to put on some music. And when we come back, we will hopefully have Susan Shapiro with us. So don't go anywhere.
Such a long, long time. Look like I get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you turns my whole world misty blue. Just the mention of your name turns the flicker to a flame. Listen to me, good baby. I think of the things we used to do, and my whole world turns misty blue. Heaven knows I've tried. Baby, when I say that I'm glad we're through, deep in my heart I know I've lied. I've lied. I've lied. Such a long, long time. Looks like I'd get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you, my love, my whole world turns misty blue.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI FM 88.9, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org. And if you just tuned in, we're about halfway through the hour, and I'm about to bring Susan Shapiro on. If you want to hear the whole show, go to iTunes, subscribe to Writers on Writing, and when we podcast the show later this week, it will arrive in your podcast file, and you'll be able to hear it from the start. So please do that. If you're so kind as to leave a little review, that would be great too. It'll help others find the show. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and Susan Shapiro is my next guest. Susan freelances for the New York Times, New York Magazine, the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, Elle, and Oprah.com. She's the best-selling author and co-author of 12 books, including Five Men Who Broke My Heart, Lighting Up, Unhooked, The Bosnia List, and the book we're going to talk about today, or at least focus on, The Byline Bible. Let's bring her on. Hi, Susan.
Hi.
Hi. Great to have you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I don't know how I discovered this book. We've been Facebook friends for a while. Maybe you mentioned it. Maybe it arrived in my mail. I don't know. But I was drawn into it right away because you get right down to it, how to start publishing nonfiction. And I'd love to hear you talk about how the book came about.
Great. Well, what happened was I studied writing at University of Michigan, and then I have a graduate degree in creative writing from NYU. And after 6 years of graduate study, writing and reading and studying with amazing Pulitzer, Nobel Prize authors, I realized I didn't even know how to write a cover letter to send out any of the work that I'd spent 6 years and thousands of dollars on. And it was frustrating because nobody really teaches it and nobody mm-hmm. really explains how one would get started. And they always say you're supposed to write the book you wanted to read and teach the class you wanted to take. So one of my professors at NYU, in a very funny way, wound up getting me a job at The New Yorker after I graduated as an assistant, as a peon for $13,000 a year. But anyway, it took me many years after my graduate degree and working at The New Yorker, it took me many years to figure out really basic stuff, like what should I send an editor, what's the difference between fiction and nonfiction, what would an editor be open for from a freelancer, what do they pay for? So it just took me so many years to figure out, and when somebody at the New School in 1993 asked if I wanted to teach for them, I told them the story, you know, and I said I spent all these thousands of dollars and I came out of all this, you know, writing schools and classes not even knowing how to write a cover letter, so I don't really want to teach poetry 101, fiction 101, journalism 101, could I invent my own method? You know, and I called it the instant gratification takes too long method, because by that point I had been writing and publishing 7 pieces a week, and that was really what was exciting. And the New School is very liberal, and they're just like, sure, whatever you want, try it. So we tried it, and it just was very exciting right from the beginning. It just took off. And I think in my first class I had 12 students. It was 15 weeks, and 8 got published, and 4 got $1,000 or more for their first pieces. So right then, I knew it worked, and I started a rule, which is if you sell a piece for over $1,000, I get dinner. And I eat for free a lot. And so that's how it started.
Yeah, that's great. You know, but why don't they teach this in college? I mean, I hear this over and over again. Writers come out of programs, and they're just mystified. Right?
Well, I understand it because I have a degree in poetry. So I would never in a million years tell somebody in 15 weeks or in 5 weeks, you could write a great poem and publish it. You could write mm-hmm. a great short story. You could write a great novel. So I absolutely understand why, you know, it's a much longer, slower process, especially for somebody that maybe wasn't an English major or, you know, is just starting. So I understand that. But what happens is there's this really interesting intersection with journalism, sort of feature journalism and creative nonfiction, where I find you absolutely could teach somebody how to do it fast. In fact, they call it journalism is literature in a hurry, or literature mm-hmm. with ADD. So what's interesting and what I developed was it turned out that there actually are several kinds of writing that I could teach in 5 weeks. You know, for example, in my book, my signature assignment that really has led to so many books and movies and TV shows and jobs and stuff is I have my students write 3 double-spaced type pages about your most humiliating secret.
Yes.
That you could put your name on. And so writing a short essay like that, if you do it well, you could get published. I mean, I've had students in 1 week get published in the New York Times and Oprah Magazine and the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post. You do have to understand 100 stupid little rules about the word count, you know, the tone, the length, what the focus is, how to do a timely lead, and nobody really teaches you how to do that. So that sort of became my niche. And I did, by the way, I absolutely love studying writing and literature and poetry. I thought that was very, very exciting, but I didn't want to be a teacher or an editor. I really wanted to see, you know, can I make a living as a writer? And I'm from Michigan, and I wanted to stay in New York City, you know, which is just, it's really, you know, very expensive, very hard to figure out. My husband lived in L.A., you know, same thing. It's very, he did TV film. It's very, very hard to figure out, and he actually started a the TV program at Tisch in New York. So we both sort of had the same idea, which is, you know, it's very hard to figure out on your own, so can we figure out a route that's a little bit closer to the way that they teach law school, medical school, or business school, where, you know, where there's a practicality attached, or a way to break in, or a way to get internships and jobs eventually.
Well, you know, I've known you on Facebook for quite a while, and I think before that ASJA, and it seems to me that you have this ability to take something that happens in the news, or just some sort of topical issue going on, and you're on it, and you have an essay written and published within days. How do you do that? I mean, how do you translate the idea so quickly to the form, really?
There's a lot of ways that I teach my students how to do that. I mean, one of them is I read 5 newspapers a day, and I actually say to my students, I have a rule, which is you have to buy the newspaper if you want the good karma of being paid by the newspaper. So I think, first of all, supporting newspapers and magazines, paper magazines especially right now, is really, really important, mm-hmm. because, you know, part of the reason why publishing is so difficult and so many newspapers and magazines are going out of business is that the internet kind of made it a little too free. And so people don't understand that, you know, if you're upset that you're not getting paid from a newspaper magazine, it might be because you didn't pay to read it. Mm-hmm. So first off, I do buy a lot of newspapers and magazines, and I study and I read them really carefully. So that helps me keep up with what's hot, what's going on, you know, what's in the, you know, pop culture. Interestingly, teaching actually helps me too, because I have a lot of 17, 18, 19-year-old undergraduates. So it's really been funny, because at one point I would make a reference to, you know, with a piece on girlfriends, I would say Marion Rota, and they would be like, who's that? And then I would say, Gossip Girls, and then they were like, okay, that's dead. And then it would be like, okay, Lena Dunham on Girls, and they're like, no, that's out. So it's like they would help me sort of figure out what pop culture references, or what, you know, what's going on. So that's part of it. I mean, another part of it, which I talk about a lot in the Byline Bible, is once you write a piece, like, you never want to finish it at 4 in the morning, think it's brilliant, and send it to The New Yorker. You always want to figure out a strategy to get criticism. Classes are great. There's ghost editors you could hire to help fix it, you know, fix your work, writing workshops. So I happen to have 2 very intense writing groups a week, so I'm always bringing in my work. And one of the benefits of sharing it publicly, aside from, you know, did you make any mistakes, or how could this be better, or it's not coming off well, is people often hear about, you know, oh my God, didn't you just read that article in the paper? That's really timely. You know, or here's something else. Like, here's an example. One of my students read a piece out loud about how she sent a boyfriend a naked picture, and he never responded to it, an ex-boyfriend. And so she read it out loud in class, and of course everybody said Bezos, you know, because he's on the front page with naked picture scandal, you know. So it actually shaped her whole piece, and I'm sure it'll get published quickly because that's what everybody's talking about now. And it actually even helped her ending, because she was so humiliated that that the boyfriend hadn't made a comment, you know, hadn't responded at all. But she realized, seeing the big scandal on the front page of all the papers, that actually he did her a favor by not responding. But so, you know, so part of it is being, you know, being up on, read newspapers, read magazines, you know, pay attention to what's going on in the news. And that really, that'll help you, you know. And if you're ever working on something that, you know, you're working on a certain piece and then something in the news corresponds with it, that's very fun to jump on, especially if you want to get published quickly in a webzine or in a daily newspaper.
Well, you know, what you said earlier about buy the newspaper, buy the magazine is, yeah, you know, I talk to a lot of writers who really want to be in these certain journals or magazines. And I say, are you a subscriber? Have you bought it? And
right.
They're like, well, you know, they're expensive. And it's like, excuse me.
Right, and sometimes you have to spend money to make money. And by the way, the same with books. You know,
right.
Buy books. If you want to be an author, don't download things for free.
Right.
You know, which you can, you know, which is illegal and immoral, you know. So that's part. I mean, you know, I've developed a whole system. I mean, I've been doing this for a long time, and I've been in therapy for a long time. And, you know, there was a lot of frustrations about trying, you know, I'm from a conservative Midwest family of doctors. So, you know, nobody was really very interested in my writing career, and it took a long time for me to develop. But what's exciting now is that now I feel like I've figured it out, and it's very exciting to be able to share it, you know, just because I moved here when I was 20 and at NYU. And so it's very exciting to have NYU and New School students who are my age who, you know, like I could save them decades of mistakes, you know, from my own experience. So it feels like all that rejection and frustration and confusion was worth it.
Yeah. Well, the Byline Bible, I think, is just, you know, a great resource. In it, you talk about so much, but we only have so much time. And I wanted to ask you about emotional arc. And you say, you know, it's important to clarify the emotional arc of your piece. And so do you know this going in when you start writing an essay, a personal essay, or is this something that happens after many drafts or somewhere in there?
All right. Well, one of the things I talk about, it's basically my 5-week class. So I give the assignments that I give for my class. So usually there's 5 different assignments that I give, and one of them is a personal essay, regional essay, op-eds, humor pieces, and service pieces. So if you want to write for mainstream newspapers, magazines, webzines, and some literary magazines, they are formulaic, which doesn't mean you can't be artful or exciting or wild or crazy, but, you know, there's definitely formulas. So there's a certain kind of personal essay, which I've written for a lot of newspapers and magazines, which is you share something, as I said, the humiliation essay, you share something intense and revealing that happened to yourself, but then you can't just, you know, sort of throw up everything that happened to you with no wisdom or no arc. So, for example, you know, one of the mistakes somebody would make is, like, here's a perfect example. So a very common piece is, like, you know, my friend ghosted me, my friend dumped me, my friend broke up with me. So, you know, a lot of people write that piece, but you can't really start a piece saying, you know, my friend dumped me, she's an idiot, I hate her, and write everything bad about her, and then start angry and end angry. So that's not interesting to read. You know, as a writer, you know, you have all the power, so it comes off sort of nasty. You don't really want to write a screed about, you know, your ex, what a jerk your ex is, what a jerk your friend that dumped you is. So you have to go somewhere, and it doesn't necessarily have to be tied up in a ribbon, but you want wisdom, you want an arc, you want a change to happen in the piece. And a lot of editors actually, you know, discuss, they have different words for it, but I call it an emotional arc. So one of the things that I find is, you know, I tell my students, before you even start writing a piece, where do you want this to go? You know, first, so do you want a New York Times Modern Love? Are you trying for the Washington Post relationship column? Are you trying for Oprah Magazine? Are you trying for the Wall Street Journal? So first you study, because each column and each editor has, you know, and each publication has a little bit of a different bent. So first you study the word count and what they're looking for, and you read a whole bunch of pieces. And then, you know, when you start to write your essay, you definitely think about, for a personal essay, where are you starting and where are you ending? And I always say my rule for first-person writing is you have to question, challenge, and trash yourself more than anyone else. So nobody wants to read a victimized kvetch about what horrible people did to you. You know, so here's an example. So I was writing a piece about my best friend kind of dumped me. My best childhood friend, who I adored, moved to California and got married and had kids, and she kind of dumped me, and she wouldn't answer my phone calls, and she wouldn't, you know, respond, and she didn't have time for me, and I felt very rejected. So that's how my piece starts. But instead of the cliche, which is, I'm going to dump her, who needs her, I'm going to move on, I wanted to do something more interesting. And so what I wound up deciding and also articulating in the piece was an understanding of what changed and what's going on in her life. And instead of me being this victim, oh, my God, my best friend isn't calling me, what I realized is, wow, she's going through a really rough time. She got married and had kids late. Her whole life changed. You know, she has a different, completely different life and different schedule than she had when we were both working girls in New York together. You know, maybe she's struggling. And I, instead of being mad at her, I tried to be compassionate. And what she basically told me was that she was having an extremely hard time readjusting and making friends and, you know, clicking into her new world. And the more she kept in touch with me and called me and emailed me, the harder it was for her to really be there for her husband and her kids and her new friends. So she had to cut me off for her own health, mental health, you know, because it didn't do her any good to be sort of back in New York as a single girl hanging out, you know, like it wasn't helping her. So I understood that, and I actually made the decision that I'm going to let her set the pace. So I'm still going to call her and email her, but if she doesn't want to contact me, that's okay. And as a best friend, as somebody who loves her, I'm going to give her all the space that she needs. And it turns out when she's in New York once a year, we have a great time. When I'm in LA, I have a great time, but I just completely changed my expectations, so I don't expect her to call me back or email me back or remember my birthday or be there for me in the way that she was. And I felt like some of her is better than none of her.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an emotional arc, you know, because again, your first instinct is to be a victim or to blame somebody. I also did that for a New York Times Modern Love piece where I had an old boyfriend who I actually wrote about in my debut book, 5 Men Who Broke My Heart, who I had this scenario in my head about how he screwed me over and all these bad things happened and he was a jerk. And I just kind of held on to that, and he never wanted to get together to talk about what happened between us. We'd gone out off and on for like 6 years, and it just was just a very difficult time in my life. I met him when I was 14, and we broke up when I was 20. So finally, years later, he happened to be in New York, and we got together to meet. And maybe because I was older, from a different perspective, we started talking, and it turns out some things in his life had been really rough. And what I realized in the piece, which I think I called A Visit and What Really Happened, was that I start out the arc kind of fantasizing in my head that he's finally going to come clean and apologize to me for being a jerk. And by the end of the piece, I have a different perspective and I wind up apologizing to him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's, you know, so yes, there are ways to, I mean, I've been in therapy a long time. There are ways to wrestle with this material with a mentor or a shrink or a teacher. But I do think just to start out, you know, what I say to my students is if you write it, you know, and people that are reading the book, and, you know, what I say is that, you know, just read your own piece. If you do a first draft, are you in the same emotional place at the beginning as you are in the end? And if so, chances are that's not enough. You didn't do enough work. You didn't wrestle with the material well enough. You're not presenting anything new or interesting or wisdom or, mm-hmm. you know, you have to fight a little bit harder, especially, you know, it's a tough market. So you can't just write some cute, funny thing. I mean, at one point, XO Jane used to publish like crazy pieces. So, you know, you'd have a crazy sexual experience. It happened to me, and you could just write this kooky thing. But that isn't around anymore. And I find that editors want more. You know, especially for the big newspapers and magazines, if they're going to pay you, they want more. They want they want emotional enlightenment or wisdom or beautiful writing or something cathartic that other readers could relate to.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. There has to be a change of some sort.
Yeah, so if you're starting out angry and ending up angry, I mean, I'll tell you a great story, which is I was helping my physical therapist, Kenan, who is a Bosnian War survivor, and I helped him. He took my class, and I helped him publish some great essays. And he was very, not all my students write funny relationship pieces like I do, so his was pretty heavy because he was the victim of ethnic cleansing because he was Muslim in Bosnia when he was a kid. And he started out writing the essays, and also publishing a piece in the New York Times led to a book that I helped him with called The Bosnia List. And he started out absolutely positively enraged at what happened to his family, as he had every right to be, and he felt that the Serbs, who it was genocide, you know, mass murder of Muslim countrymen, they never apologized. He was a walking rage ball, and I explained to him, even though it's justified in an essay and in a book, you can't start out enraged and hating a whole people and end up enraged and hating a whole mm-hmm. people. And at one point, he wrote a list of 12 Serbs who betrayed his family, Christian Orthodox Serbs, who betrayed his family, including his karate coach and his teacher. And he just said, I'm not forgiving. There's no forgetting. There's no forgiving. Nothing's ever going to change. And we needed an arc for the memoir, which Penguin published in 2014. But so at one point, he kept saying, you know, nobody really helped our family. And I said, you know, once you told me the story, that's not true. There actually were. There was a bus driver who waited for you in the snow to help your family get out, and there was someone that slipped you money. And I said to him, you know, could you write a list of everybody who helped your family? And he said, I could count them on one finger. And I said, no, you can't. Let's write a list. And there were 12 people who helped his family. So the arc of the book, and I actually thought the minute he figured that out, that was the arc of the book, and that made the whole book work, which was that there were 12 people who betrayed his family, but then he remembered there was 12 Serbs who helped him. You know, so I work with people about, I work with people on that, but I do think, you know, and I try to write about it in the Byline Bible, how do you find an arc? How do you find the wisdom? How do you find the emotional depth or cathartic revelation in a piece? You know, and I think Joan Didion has this great line, which is, I write entirely to find out what I'm thinking.
Right.
So sometimes just writing a first draft of an essay is a really good way to, you know, to sort of mine the material. And again, your most humiliating secrets. So usually that involves, you know, a trauma or a breakup or, you know, getting fired or an addiction or, you know, something horrible happening with your family or an illness. So usually... with first-person essays, it's great to grapple with something heavy, and a lot of times just the process of writing itself starts helping you.
Yeah. Well, this book, there's so much more I would love to talk to you about, and we're running out of time. So I encourage everyone to check out the Byline Bible, get published in 5 weeks, published by Writer's Digest Books. And it's by Susan Shapiro, who has a website that you can find out so much more. But I wanted to ask you one little thing, and that was, and it's a mechanics question, and that is that you say to write personal essays in the past tense. Why past tense?
Well, a lot of reasons. First, it's more honest. You know, because you're usually writing about a story that really happened. You know, it happened in past tense. So my girlfriend broke my heart, that happened in past tense, and I figured it out in past tense. So it's just, number one, it's more honest, because present tense is a conceit. You know, so for example, when I'm writing the piece, when I'm writing the piece about my best friend, if I were to write it, she's not calling me back. I'm waiting by the phone.
Right.
She's not returning my phone calls. I mean, it's kind of like it's a little bit of a fake-a-rooney conceit, you know, because you're pretending that something is happening in real time when it already happened in past tense. So the first reason, I think, is just that, it's more honest. You know, so just for an example, like, okay, I have the essay right there. So I saw, happy birthday, butterfly. I left the phone message for my best friend, Claire, using her childhood nickname. She never returned the call. I knew she was busy with two babies, but she didn't respond to my last three emails later. I was beyond hurt. I mean, so that's just honest, and it's something that happened, and it feels very normal to read that.
Right.
If I were to say, happy birthday, butterfly, I leave the phone message for my best friend, Claire. She never returns the call. If I use present tense, again, it's a bit of a conceit. Now, it works better when you're using present tense. It works better if you're doing fiction, if you're doing a poem, if you're writing if you're in the middle of a memoir that maybe is about childhood trauma. You know, it is more immediate, you know, if you want to do present tense. But if you read the essays in the newspapers and magazines that I'm talking about, 99% of them are in past tense. And I think it's very hard to pull off present tense. I do have a great line that I use with Writing in Love, which is, you could do anything as long as it works.
Mm-hmm.
And every once in a while, maybe like, one in 5,000 will, you know, a student will show me a piece that they have a reason why they want it to work in present tense, and it can work, but it's very difficult, and it's also more artistic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's sort of it's an artistic camouflage. You know, you're pretending that this thing is happening in real time. So if there's a good reason to do it, you can actually do it in humor. I think I did, I have a book, Lighting Up, How I Stopped Smoking, Drinking, and Everything Else I Loved in Life Except Sex. And when I wrote a humor piece about the first day that I quit smoking, I did it as a diary of, like, you know, 10 a.m., woke up and put the patch on. You know, and so for addiction, there might be a reason. If you're writing about addiction, there might be a reason to do present tense, so you're taking people through your day as it's happening. But in general I find present tense for essays, and also second person, I find an artistic conceit that usually doesn't work. Now, by the way, you know, I usually work with beginning writers of all ages who've never published anything before. You know, once you're at a certain level, you know, once you understand the rules, you could do anything, you know, and you could make anything work. So I'm not saying across the board an essay cannot be in present tense, but I get a lot of people who say, my goal in life is, I want to be in New York Times Modern Love. I want to be in Washington Post Soloish. I want to be in the Wall Street Journal. I want to be in New York Magazine's The Cut. So if you read those pieces, it's very rare that you would see a present tense piece.
Mm. Susan, you are just wonderful, and I love this book. And
thank you. By the way, I've done some great events in L.A. I'm going to come back over the summer.
Oh, let us know.
I love it there. Yeah, so much fun.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. That was Susan Shapiro. Her book is The Byline Bible, Get Published in 5 Weeks. It really is wonderful. If you are doing nonfiction and you want to get yourself out there, get your stuff published, it really is useful. And that's all the time we have today. This hour went so fast. Thank you for being here. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we'll see you next time.